If you follow what's going on in the fashion world, you might have had your eye on Milan Fashion Week, where sleek models recently strutted down runways in cutting-edge garments by the world's top designers. An event like that showcases more than just clothing. It's also part theater. Models get in character, and they appear in a set that someone designs. One of the artists whose creation set the stage for this year's fashion show is originally from Blue Springs. She went to the Kansas City Art Institute, went on to become a nationally recognized artist, and now it seems her career is hitting that international tier. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're starting today's show with Rachel Hayes, just back from Milan Fashion Week. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Gina.
So it's great to hear from you. You partnered with the designer Missoni. How did that partnership come about?
Well, I was contacted through Instagram by Angela Missoni, and she sent me a picture that she really liked that I'd posted, that I'd taken at this empty lot in downtown Tulsa where I live now. And it was a beautiful sunset, and my brother was in town, and we decided to do a spontaneous photo shoot. And the great thing about Instagram is they have a platform to put some of those spontaneous ephemeral projects out there on, and I have no idea how she found it, but she contacted me and said, I love this piece. Would you be willing to collaborate on a project in September?
Back up and tell me what the piece okay. looked like. What was it that she saw?
It was actually a piece that I made for a show that was in Wichita last year, and it was hanging in a gallery. And
what does it look like? So for our listeners who have never seen your work.
Okay. It's a patchwork of various silks and polyesters that are both opaque and sheer, and flag fabrics. And it was the scraps that I had from a previous large project that I sewed together into, it's like it's kind of like a grid-like pattern. But it's pretty put together in an intuitive way.
You know, I am going to describe in general what your art looks like to me. And
okay.
We'll see if this rings true for you. To me, it looks like you build brightly colored fabric sculptures. And a lot of people think of sculpture as being something like bronze, you know, something solid. But these are, they're giant structures, but they're made out of this light material that sort of flaps in the wind, and you put it places like out in the world, like on a beach or stretched across the canyon, and they add these striking, brightly colored accents to natural wonders, which sounds maybe kind of insane, because does a natural wonder really require an accent? But it makes you see things differently.
Yeah, I love that description. I was literally describing the one piece, but you described my work very, very well. And I think of them as that way too. They're environmental, they're physical, they are, you know, taking up space. You can have a relationship with your body and the environment. And then there's also, I guess the ones that are out in the landscape, they're not unlike responding to like an architectural space. Like with one of the pieces that maybe you're thinking of is there's like a striped panel of fabric that goes across a lake.
Yeah.
And I went to that spot. That's in Roswell, New Mexico. Just on like a family hike, and was not scouting or anything, but I remember coming upon that spot and thinking, oh my gosh, like I could visualize what I wanted to make there. And
when you talk about that, it's an experience with not just the environment, like out in the world, but that it's also a way of, it's an experience involving your body. Something that has an image that has popped into my mind when I've seen your work is like when you were a kid and you play with those big fabric parachutes in gym class and everyone runs underneath them, but they fly up and then they land and they're these kind of crazy color patterns that you kind of get under and then into the side of. Is that something that you can relate to?
Yes. But it's also something that it's something that I realize in hindsight that must have had a really huge impact on, you know, deep in the back of my head, I think. Because the first time I ever, you know, made these large things, I was not thinking about that at all. But obviously, I loved that too, and it does provoke a feeling of, you know, excitement and wonder and awe, and you're experiencing it with other people, so you're all feeding off each other's energy, and you know what?
What?
Also in hindsight, it just reminds me so much of, I did a piece for Avenue of the Arts.
Here in Kansas City.
Yeah, in 2004. That was my first, like, outdoor project. And it was a huge panel of fabric that my mom helped me sew, and we covered one of the glass skywalks by downtown on Central Avenue. And we had to get everyone that we knew, like all of my family, all of my husband's family and friends, anyone. It took like 30 of us to install this piece. And it was so amazing. You know, you've got this giant, you know, 200-foot piece of fabric that you haul up together on top of this building. And then you lower it down. And when it was down there on the ground, kind of waiting to be pulled up around the other side of the building, there's about 20 of us down below having that experience together. And it was awesome.
With the fabric just falling.
With the fabric, it was just blowing in the wind. And everyone's just trying to keep control over it so it doesn't just flop around. And
that sounds really fun.
It was really fun, and it was not something that I anticipated happening at all, because, you know, I was coming at it as more like, we've got a job to do, we've got to get this done and not have the fabric rip. And it was
very stressful.
And here's
what it's going to look like in the end.
And this is what it's going to look like in the end. But then all these things happen in between, and then also just like documenting the whole process of lowering it down on the building, and it looks like dripping paint as the fabric's like coming down, and then having the experience below, and then pulling it back on the other side, and then everyone that was on top of the building trying to secure it, they're all having their own experience too. And then it was a glass building, so we could all go inside afterwards, and you can kind of stand within the piece. So there are all these things that I never anticipated happening that have like basically become what I would want to achieve in everything that I do. Yeah.
You know, how did you originally start developing this style? Because it's interesting that you reference that it looked like the fabric falling from the sky looked like dripping paint, because as much as I was comparing it earlier to sculpture, it's also like you're painting with fabric too, but you're kind of painting in the sky.
Yeah. And the piece that you mentioned in Milan, in the photographs, it's like, what is this? Like, what am I looking at? It looks like a painting in the sky. It's so abstract. It's hard to like even kind of,
yeah, like
if you're familiar with my work.
Interlocking squares that almost look like a color maze painting in the sky.
Yeah. Well, way back when I was at the Art Institute, most of my friends were in painting, and I spent a lot of time with them. And my husband, Eric Saul, is a painter, and I loved everything that I learned in the fiber department. Like, the materials are definitely my muse, but I loved some of the freedom that they had in the painting department.
Freedom
You
in
know,
what
I was
sense?
just to kind of pursue some of their own ideas,
Like
rather than working project based. Like,
in fiber, is there pressure to make a garment or something functional?
no, not at all. Especially not when I was there. Like, I actually was torn between fiber and sculpture when picking a department, and ended up choosing fiber because to me, it felt like a sculptural department. And you know, there was a handful. It's an interesting, like, back and forth between the functional and the non-functional, and that goes on in that department. That is great, but I remember, kind of craving like some of the things that they were talking about too. So I would, a couple of friends and I, we would often invite professors from other departments to have critiques in fiber, hoping that other departments might do the same thing. And anyways, let's see. What my point was is
How this
that
all started, this
my
sort
point
of unique
was
visual
that,
language of yours.
yeah, okay. There's a definite memory.
Oh. It sounds.
And I came into class, make some drawings.
Rachel, our connection is getting a little funky. Would you mind repeating
Can you
what
hear
you just
me?
said? Yes, but it's a little bit spotty, so let's just try again.
Okay, where did I leave off? Let's see.
That you
I
had
can.
invited professors from other departments to come and do critiques in the fiber department.
Right. So then I took a class in the painting department, an abstract drawing class with Jim Brinsfield, and I brought my papers and pencils, and I was gonna make some abstract drawings. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. And he's familiar with my work because I had previously brought him in for a critique. And he said, "Rachel, what you're doing is already abstract drawing. And you know, you're making abstraction." And it so it gave me he said he was like, "You just should bring your sewing machine into class and work on your art. Do what you're doing over there, over here." And that was kind of a game changer for me to be able to think of my work in a new context.
You know, after leaving the Kansas City Art Institute, you went on to grad school and then a pretty well-known artist residency in New Mexico called Roswell. It's been around since 1967. I'm curious, what drew you there and how did that set the stage for the way you set up your career now? Because it seems like artists' residencies are a big part of your process.
Right. We first heard about it through, Steve Fleming was a professor at the Art Institute, and he's been the director there for the past 20 plus years. And he had a show at the Joseph Nice Gallery, and
In
I
Kansas
had
City.
in Kansas City at the time. And I had some work in there as well. And so we got to meet him there, and through Joe and Karen, and everyone encouraged us to apply. That was the first time I'd ever heard of an artist in residence program. And then when we got there, Eric and I went together. We were 25, and we were surrounded by people who had been doing this for a long time, like people, you know, in their 50s, 60s. And so it was an eye opener, like, that we could this live the artist lifestyle, and this is what we could really try to make a go of this. And
And you do this, I mean, now your career, we've talked about the kind of settings that you work in, that these are outdoor environments a lot of the time, and you do all this working while traveling with a family, your artist husband, Eric, who you've mentioned, and two small kids.
Right. Well, I can sew anywhere. I can sew in my home. I can sew in my studio. So it's a very malleable form for me to work in, surrounded by my kids. And I've planned it in a way so that it's fun. It's fun for them. It's fun for us. Like to do some of these outdoor projects, they're like self-commissioned installations, and just in hopes of, like something that I wanted to see out in the world, and to document that and put it out there and see what happens, and to just try to make it fun for them as well.
Rachel Hayes, we're going to keep an eye on you as you go from your national parks to international fashion shows. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Gina.
Artist Rachel Hayes has just come home to the U.S. after designing the set for Missoni at Milan Fashion Week. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Two things you might not expect to go together, art and military training, have found their way into a new project at the Todd Weiner Gallery. It's a study of all the gifts from high-ranking foreign officers who have been coming to Fort Leavenworth for their education since 1894. Lavish brass incense and rosewater sets, a birdcage from Tunisia, an Islamic prayer mat, and a set of mosaic dinner plates that say Shalom in English and Hebrew. What's the story behind this international collection of gifts? To talk about that now, let's turn to curators Megan Dohan and Poppy DeCandeloro. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank
and
you.
And hi,
for having
Poppy.
Us.
Hello.
So, okay, tell me the story of how your art gallery hooked up with the college at Fort Leavenworth to sort of begin to mine this gigantic collection of gifts.
It was a day back in March of 2016 where one of our friends actually was a new trustee to the college, Wesley Westmoreland. He invited Todd and I up to the Command and General Staff College for just a visit, just to see what was going on and really experience the great work that they were doing up there. So it started as an informal tour, a walk and talk. And when we
to
got,
just go see what was there.
Just to see what was there.
What did you see? What really caught your eye?
It was amazing and very unexpected. I think most people associate Leavenworth with a prison and that all that is there. And it was distinctly opposite. We go on to base. There's this magnificent school to the left and the right and these sprawling golf course and all of these people living there and working. And we got up to the Command and General Staff College, which is a new building built to educate our military officers. So just grand. And all of these gifts were in cases around the school. And so we were kind of, Todd and
just
I...
Just throughout the whole school, not like in a designated spot.
Right. Just in these four-story glass cases all around the school. And Todd and I kind of gave each other a look and we were like, what's going on? You know, these are the things that catch our eye.
So what made you think that there was something more to do here than just take a tour and appreciate it and go home and maybe think fondly about the experience from time to time?
Yeah, well, we started asking. we're kind of inquisitive that way. When we saw the objects, we asked, what's going on here? What are you doing with these? What are these? That sort of thing. And their responses to those questions really prompted us to kind of explore further.
Can you give me an example of an object you saw and what you were curious about and then what you learned about it?
There's one that really sticks in my mind that was kind of the launch point to everything. In the Roberts room, which is on the first floor of the facility, there's this Taiwanese scroll that spans across a case, and it's depicting horses running through a field. And what really stuck in my mind was just the way that it was presented, and recognizing that that's maybe not exactly how most scrolls that I have seen have been presented. And so prompting the question, why is this like this? Where did this come from? That was kind of the pivot point for us. So we decided, I think that this may be done in a different way that might make more sense.
So you're talking about the way it was presented was not how a curator or an arts organization would have presented it, just based on your knowledge of art.
Yes. In terms of the mounting of the scroll and what was surrounding it, it's almost as if everything is kind of hodgepodge together, which is the resources that they had. It's what they were able to do with the collection at the time. But there's so much of a greater story that can be told with some context, with really making sure that these things are displayed correctly, with lighting, with all of those factors that make it bigger and grander.
So give me an example of a story to be told with one of these objects.
Oh, well, I guess we can start with thinking about the exhibitions that we put together. We've had four exhibitions outside of the college, and the first one was exhibited in September of 2016, last year, which was the first time that the objects were actually allowed to leave the college. So that was a pretty exciting event. And that took place at the Todd Weiner Gallery. There were 10 items, I believe. They were divided up into decades. So taking a theme of decades and one object from each decade starting in 1943, which was when the first gift was given to the college.
So can we back up and talk about this gift-giving tradition? Because it's sort of fascinating that two things about this are fascinating to me. One is my long-standing assumption, which we all know what you do when you assume, but yes. Long-standing assumption that the people coming to this college are American military officers in training, strictly speaking. That turns out not to be the case. And B, that there are these sort of symbolic exchanges of gifts upon graduation that is this long-standing tradition that has created this incredible collection of art, but not just art that's created to be art, but also objects, like functional objects, like the incense burners and prayer mats and things like that I was talking about. This tradition is fascinating to me.
I would say it is so fascinating in that, yes, there are over 180 countries represented in this college. So just quickly, what the school is for is to bring officers into the Command and General Staff College for a year of military training, where at the end they come out with a Master's of Art in Military Sciences. At the end of that year in May, what the tradition has become is that the foreign officers and those who just want to give a token of gratitude to the school will meet with the Deputy Commandant, present their gift, have a moment of exchange in front of this backdrop of all of the flags represented of the UN and their flag in particular, right alongside the United States, where, again, it's an exchange. It's a moment of thank you, a moment of almost dedicating your next steps to upholding what you've learned here.
How do people select the gifts that they are going to present? What's the meaning and significance in that?
Well, I think that has changed since the first gift ever given. As I was referring to, the first gift ever given was given in 1943, and it was by two Polish officers who appreciated their time at the Command and General Staff College. And so upon their graduation, they gave a plaque, and I believe it has an eagle on it. It's just a silver eagle with a little bit of text across the bottom on a wooden plaque. So that is probably one of the most popular gifts, and especially from about 1943 to about the 1980s, although intermingled with that are...
But wait, can we stick with this Polish gift for a second and get a little deeper into the significance? Because it seems like in 1943, what's going on internationally is sort of the tail end of World War II. Yes. Poland being situated in a very particular place, both geographically and politically within that conflict. And here is this gift from Poland to the U.S. in a military officer training school.
Correct.
The choice of gift seems like it would have some significance, be sending some kind of message. Is that accurate?
I think you get it.
But wait, what is the message?
I think what we recognize is the choice of gift is something that is individual to each person attending the school, but also the country. These gifts are emblematic of craftsmen from their country, of certain maybe woodworkers, of certain metal workers. So when we try to place the Polish plaque in context, there was a major uprising in Poland during 1943 where really people were fighting to keep their way of life, to maintain. There's this turmoil. There's chaos going on. And those officers who attended the military college are trying to take back the skills that they've learned to maybe quell some of that, to maybe make sure that when they're back in Poland, it's a better Poland than when they left.
There are a lot of religious objects included in this collection, which also surprises me, given the setting and context.
Well, I think that probably speaks to the country in which the gift is being given. Again, so in the collection, there, just to give you an idea of what is in the collection, plaques, as I have mentioned, is a prominent example of a gift given. But there are things such as chalices, things such as wooden carvings of sculptures of animals and figures, people in, sometimes there might be a small village carved into into wood. There are paintings, there are scrolls, there are just housewares objects. We have dram glasses or shot glasses from Spain with Gaudi's designs on the outside.
Wow.
Dinner plates, tobacco boxes. I mean, the jewelry boxes with jewelry. The list of objects really doesn't end. I mean, belt buckles, patches, all different kinds of things. So every time we go out there and we open a box, we're surprised at what is inside because sometimes it does not match what we think it might be. So what was the question?
You've answered. When you look at the different decades of gifts, you were saying that the first exhibits sort of charted the gifts decade by decade. Do you notice a pattern over time of how this tradition has evolved and changed, or has it stayed pretty steady and consistent?
The tradition has stayed the same, and it's probably increased a little bit. There are, looking through the spreadsheets, you can see in some time periods, there are more countries. There are more countries being represented than, say, in the 1980s. There might be how many countries represented in the spreadsheet? I don't know. We'll just say
spreadsheets you're keeping to document what you're finding.
Yes. So we'll say 15 countries are represented in the 1980s. But then in the 1990s, there might be less than that. So we can kind of chart a little bit, kind of tracking how many gifts are given from what countries, and that, we can sort of track political interests and things like that.
What's interesting, too, is you can kind of trace that lineage. So let's isolate Italy, for example. We can take the information that we do have and go back and look at all of the gifts that Italy has given and see if there's a consistency there. Are they giving statuesque figures of prominent people in Italian history? Are they giving weapons? And both ring true for Italy, but that's something that's really interesting that can be done with all of the countries, and each country has its own story. So there isn't a consistency in terms of evolution within the gift giving, but each country has a tale to tell. And
can you tell me one of those tales? Pick a country and the story that you were able to uncover based on the gifts coming from that country, from officers in training in Fort Leavenworth to the U.S.
I think they're each, like I said, each is interesting, but we have kind of followed the narrative of some of those. One in particular would be maybe Singapore. The current Prime Minister of Singapore is a graduate of CGSC and in the International Hall of Fame. So for one of our exhibitions, we isolated his gift and had that
What was his gift?
He gave a ship, a large glass ship.
Large meaning what?
I would say, no, that's a fair question.
So not the size of a real ship.
No.
Large for art.
Maybe replica ship. Yes. table topper, if you will. But what's interesting about maybe the lineage of that story is that when he gave the gift, he was part of the ASEAN League.
What is that?
It's a League of Nations of Asian countries. So they were coming as a united group rather than just Singapore. So although the country was represented, there are times when we can see the evolution of a country and even the name changed. So Bosnia and Herzegovina together, then separate. The Soviet Union
and Russia, yes.
Yugoslavia, Russia, countries that no longer exist are represented in this register. Countries that are newly formed are represented in this register.
So there's been a little bit of coverage of your project in the Smithsonian and in fact on KCUR's website, kcur.org. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that in many cases, it seems like the work you are doing is providing information to the school in Leavenworth about what it is they have, things that they had not realized about these objects to begin with. A bronze sculpture depicting what was believed to be a cowboy comes to mind.
That's an interesting gift. Yeah, that gift was given by Landon Rowland, a prominent figure in Kansas City, as a token of gratitude to CGSC in general. He was a trustee for the college, I believe, and that is a unique gift because it was done in the tradition of a Remington. So this old-fashioned soldier who's riding horseback and charging into battle, and when you really take a look at it, you're like, well, that's an interesting weapon to be riding into battle. And it actually was from a modern-day conflict when soldiers were dropped down, I believe it was in Iraq, and had to ride horseback into conflict. And 2001, I think.
Wow, that recent.
That recent. So there is this kind of...
So this, what appeared to be an old-timey cowboy was actually a 21st century American soldier in Iraq?
Yes, a special forces officer.
Wow. So... The project is called The Art of War, which kind of surprises me because military training obviously prepares people for conflict, among other things, though. I mean, that the Art of War seems like a provocative title, but I'm curious about the meaning and understanding that you bring to that idea.
So it's the full title of it is The Art of War, Gifts of Peace. So again, thinking about this sort of dichotomy that we have between the military college and all of these art and gifts that have been given to the college. So in our title, we are again looking at this dichotomy of military and art. And so I think that's kind of where the title comes from. But again, these gifts are given at a time of appreciation and gratitude. So they're given in peaceful times. Although the reasoning behind that may be a little bit more chaotic.
Can you give an example of a chaotic reason for something that's maybe, I don't know, complicates this idea we have of times of peace and times of war? That there, it seems like it's not always so neatly one or the other.
That is correct.
Yeah, the school's motto is actually, in times of peace, prepare for war. So that connects pretty interestingly. A specific example, there are so many, but the kind of theme there is that you can trace political relations through the college just by looking at who gave gifts when. There are times when a country is there one year and not there the next.
It's a really fascinating story. Megan Dohan, Poppy DeCandeloro, thank you so much for joining us from Todd Weiner Gallery.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, we will talk about the gospel song Hold On with Isaac Cates. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Isaac Cates and the Ordained have released a timely new interpretation of the gospel song Hold On. It starts like this.
5 people were killed and at least 8 people wounded after a gunman began randomly shooting passengers at the Fort Lauderdale airport.
321, we have shots fired. We have one suspect down. We need him to hear.
Well, he's got his hands up there for now. That's got a feeling that's about to happen.
That looks like a bad dude, too. To be honest.
10 days ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and in 5 days, I'm starting intensive chemotherapy.
The video of the song goes back and forth between Kansas City-based gospel group, the one performing, Isaac Cates and the Ordained, and scenes of violence and heartache straight out of the daily news delivered in the gruesome form we've become accustomed to in 2017. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with the musician and choir director behind this vision. Isaac Cates, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a pretty powerful combination. Later on, the lyrics move from hold on to fight on,
mm-hmm.
but from really disturbing news to hold on, those just the call to action that we've become accustomed to, this seems like something different.
It is. First of all, I wanted to initially, thank you for having me on to talk about this. When I initially put out the song and released the video, at the beginning of the year, it came on the heels of so much tension. Last year, it was really, really tense. It was a really, really tense climate as we were kind of getting through the election and kind of gotten to the point where, and of course, you know, in January where the results came in, I thought it was just the climate of our country specifically, was really, really, everyone had an opinion, you know, and I guess everyone always does, but everyone, I didn't know that we're so influenced by the right now of culture, of what we see that's in front of us. Sometimes we can negate the history.
Like the long arc?
Yes. And so, for instance, I think if people put together an opinion, I think it should be an opinion that's based upon just a certain amount of knowledge, you know, facts and history. And I think black male, I related a lot to what's going on and what has happened. And as someone who's also studied, some of the things that's happened.
When you say what's going on, what do you mean?
Right now there's an extreme amount of tension, racial tension, and it's always kind of been, but it's manifested because of some of the things that have been that are now kind of in plain sight. You know, one of the things that's helped is that we've had, like, you know, phones. So people, some of the things, some of the atrocities that happen in years past, you know, weren't necessarily documented, from police brutality to, you know, racial profiling to all of these things, you know. And so I guess part it's interesting because I had a kind of a complicated perspective, in that it in the video, we didn't just show, we showed, you know, things that had to do specifically with, you know, horrible atrocities, racial tension. But we also showed things as far across the spectrum as cancer.
Yeah, people in hospitals, yes, hugging each other.
People like, and also there were images of, I think, Hurricane Katrina. And it was to remind us of our humanity. A lot of the things that I think have happened in the world, and specifically in America, because we do this whole thing with the dehumanization of people. So we don't, the lack of empathy. You know, slavery happened, you know, because of, there's no empathy, you know.
What made this song come to mind? This is a cover.
Yes. Well, it's a traditional spiritual, and I've always thought it was a really, really, the spiritual is extremely powerful because it's not necessarily a religious perspective, you know, i.e. Christian or anything. It's birthed out of, this song is specifically birthed out of the African experience of singing a story, or of encouragement, or telling a story through the words. And so I thought it was really, really powerful. Initially, I grew up hearing the song, you know, in church, and hearing it, and hearing my grandparents kind of hum these sort of things. But then there was a group called Sounds of Blackness, out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, which they are a really, really socially conscious group, Gary Hines. And I was really, really empowered and influenced by that. And I thought, okay, what a great message to remind people to hold on, because things are not the greatest right now, but I had to remind people that they've been worse historically, you know, I mean, in this country, in the world. I think we even showed images that were reflecting of, like, the Holocaust as well, because that's something that happened. You know, this is and so I wanted to remind people. So it says, hold on, fight on just a little while longer. Everything will be all right. So I wanted it as a message of encouragement.
Do hold on and fight on sound to you like different messages, or are they part of some bigger process or order of events that need to unfold? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's, yeah, I think it is a part of a bigger, because, you know, trauma, when anytime something traumatic happens, it's, you know, some people respond to it differently. You know what I mean? Especially depending on how traumatic it was for you. You know, so some people, it's hanging on to their, hold on to your faith, hold on to your patience. Some people, it's hold on to your mouth. Hold on to your post that you're getting ready to make on social media, because you may not be in, or you may not be in the right state of mind to do so. It's hold on. Hang on. Don't give up, because despair.
Or maybe be thoughtful, not rash, or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. It is totally that. And then just, you know, it's both sides of that. I think for some people, it's hold on because despair kind of sets in, you know, for some people. And then when despair sets in, it's very dangerous, because people abandon their human mindset, you know, so people go off and they want to shoot people and they want to fight and they want to be angry, you know, and so we have to be very careful of that. And then fight on, for the people who, you know, really do want to make a change, and want to see, something different as a result of their actions. I think people need to understand it's a process, you know what I mean? And I, when I was speaking with Matt, I gave him the perspective of, I think at some point people need to be sure that their minds are also involved with their emotions, you know, to just go off an emotional thing is not always the best thing, you know? So when I say fight on, you think about the civil rights movement. That was a whole fight. And I can, from the Black experience, you know, but it wasn't a fight with literal fists. It was a fight with the process. Nonviolence actually was the fight. So it's not always the way that people think, to win a battle, you know what I mean? And it doesn't happen overnight. You know,
There's a message of patience and of taking the long view that I've heard, I mean, just not your message in specific, but mm-hmm. that message in general. I've heard some critique of that message as being sort of, I don't know, the idea that the people making that argument are often sitting in a place of privilege where, well, it's easy to say, be patient when you don't have to deal with this every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested that you are coming, you know, you've said specifically from this perspective of being a Black man. And most people would look at that and say, well, that's a person who has to deal with this every single day. Mm-hmm. Is that patience? Do you believe that that's serving you and that that's I don't know, like a reasonable thing to expect of people?
Yes. I can only do it from my perspective. I think one of the issues is that people try to, I think you have to use the platform that you've been given. My gift and my platform is music. And so I let the music speak, whereas sometimes words into the rhetoric aren't necessarily always a good thing. When it comes to being patient, absolutely. I do believe that there should be some patience, but it's not, waiting or patient, without action. You know what I'm saying? It's being calculated in the things that you say, in the words that you speak, in the relationships that you develop, in your educational process. You know what I mean? I think one of the most dangerous things to do is to be empowered and passionate about something that you don't really have a full scope of things. You know what I mean? From the Black perspective, and I don't claim to be anybody's expert on that, but I have done a lot of, research and reading on things. It's a book, and she's a wonderful, wonderful author and speaker. Her name is Dr. Joy DeGry, and she talks about this thing called post-traumatic slave syndrome, which is very fascinating. I think she was at Portland State University, and she's done some wonderful writings. And basically, she takes the whole idea of the PTSD, which is, based upon trauma that you've had by witnessing or experiencing the event. And it is, she talks about, there are two sides to this thing. She talks about this stuff called cognitive dissonance, which is basically where you, and this is psychological, terminology, and I'm an expert in that, but it made so much sense that people, it's basically a fancy word for your moral compass. You know what I mean? So it's easy to say, from a, let's say a white perspective, that I don't, that's their problem. That's their fault. Or things are not as bad as they seem. But inside, it's opposite of you saying what your morals are. So if you say, for instance, I believe everyone should have equal rights and everyone should be able to, no, I don't, this doesn't exist. That's them. You're putting that distance up, especially if your actions are opposite of that which you say you believe. And so that's what you talk about. And so it's easy to, and it's in the story, it's in our history. I mean, you think about the writings of Carl von Linnaeus, who we consider to be, they consider to be the father of modern anthropology. He wrote these characteristics that were based on, they called them science, of personality traits of all these of different nationalities. And, if you look at them, it's not fair in many of the things that he said. And so, I think a lot of it has to do with the knowledge base.
In your interpretation of mm-hmm. Hold On, there's a sound, there's like this sort of marching, this march of both patience and persistence.
Yes.
And I'm interested in what the sound of the song brings to the message.
Yeah. When we were recording the song initially, I recorded with my group Ordained. And interesting story about it is that we started recording it probably close to a year prior to us actually putting it out. We started the session and I didn't like it because I felt like it didn't have enough pain in it. And I just said, we're singing for everybody who is in some sort of painful situation right now. You know what I mean? Whether it's socially, whether it's physically, whether it's with their health. And so I wanted it to have a strength to it, but specifically I wanted to sing it from the Black experience, which has a lot to do with that moan. It has a lot. And the reason why it's a cappella is that I wanted you to be able to feel that visceral, kind of scenario of the pain, the angst, the perseverance. It's easy to say hold on, but it's hard to receive it from somebody that's feel like they've never had to hold on through anything. It's just like when you talk to an older person or your mother, or your grandfather, and they tell you, you'll be okay. It'll be all right. You'll be, you know, and how do you know? Because you see the gray hairs in their head, because you see they've lived through things. And so we wanted it to have some years on it. We wanted it to have some pulse to it. And the marching sound behind it is to resemble, to assimilate, I'm sorry, make a resemblance of unity, a group of people.
We're listening to Hold On by Isaac Cates and the Ordained, a Kansas City gospel group. And you can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. Isaac Cates, thank you.
Thank you.
This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chin, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.